Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Our guest today, Doug Baring. Doug, it's great to have you on. I really appreciate you being here. And first of all, Doug, tell us where you're calling in from and what you do for a living with Little Diablo Salsa.
Right outside of Detroit, Michigan. We make all natural shelf stable salsa. We've been doing it for about 12 years now. We use all fresh vegetables, no chemicals, no preservatives. We hand chop everything. We make small batches and we can it just like grandma used to.
That's amazing. I love that. And tell me a little bit more about your background. I mean, what kind of you're interested in doing, you know, getting into this space? And I guess what was something you noticed out there in the market with, you know, similar types of products that you were looking to do a little bit better or maybe differently with this brand?
So I have a culinary background, so I'm a chef by trade. Huge foodie, love good, healthy food. I could not find a good salsa in the store. And this was 12, 15 years ago before there was 1,000 different salsas out there, even before the fresh salsas were starting to get some traction. There was just the basic, you know, that you'd find in the snack aisle that was full of chemicals, thickeners, made with paste, dehydrated vegetables, dehydrated garlic. I just thought we could do better. There should be something better out there. And we developed it and started making it, giving it to neighbors, friends, family. Everybody loved it. We started doing fairs, farmers markets, eventually started getting to some stores. And after, you know, a year or so as a hobby, I quit my job, made it a full-time thing and bought a building and built it out and started making it professionally.
That's amazing. I love that. And I suppose when you started, what was your general kind of, I guess, when you quit your job and really put 2 feet into this thing to do it full time, what was your kind of, I guess, go-to-market strategy with where you were looking to sell it? Were you looking to work with like wholesalers directly? Were you looking to do more of like getting into food service or like even selling direct to consumer mostly? What was your kind of general, you know, perspective of where you were looking to sell your salsa when you really put 2 feet into this project?
At the time, I had no clue.
Fair enough.
I knew I wanted to see it in stores. I didn't know the process. You know, the first step is proof of concept, obviously. And we started selling it online, e-commerce, and that was doing really well. But our main focus was to get people to know it was a good salsa, because most people say, oh, it's in a jar, it can't be good. So we started entering into a lot of contests, salsa contests, hot sauce contests. And a lot of the contests were taking place in Texas, California, New Mexico. And we started winning first place, gold medals, blue ribbons. So at that point, we kind of knew we were onto something if we were beating out salsas made in Texas. So I started jokingly call it the salsa from Detroit City. So that was kind of our nudge a little bit. We knew we had a good salsa. Then we started approaching stores and local stores in the area. Started getting to a lot of, I mean, you walk in with a sample, they say, yeah, bring it in. That was real easy because they were small mom and pops. Then we started getting into some bigger chains, which weren't as easy, but there's a lot of stores, small chains in Michigan that really support local. And that was our stepping stone. Then we got to the Kroger's and the Meyers, you know, the Sendick's and some of the bigger chains out there.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I always love hearing the stories because obviously getting into wholesale, kind of like the larger chains, it's really hard to do it if you don't have the proof of concept behind you, whether it's winning awards or whether it's you're in a bunch of local stores or whether you have a big online presence selling direct to consumer already. I think it's really important to kind of have, you know, that leg to stand on when you go into those conversations to gather interest, first of all, but also make sure that you're not getting like, you know, a terrible deal. I have a lot of CPG brands on the podcast. That's one of the biggest pain points that I hear is just these like crazy fees that people are paying and razor thin margins are doing, you know, 20,000 units a month and making, you know, like 5,000 a month from it. It's really interesting. I think that perspective is really important. A lot of people that listen to the podcast, I think, are other entrepreneurs in the CPG space as well. So, you know, somebody who's been doing it as long as you have, I think it's really good advice for anybody listening. So I appreciate you sharing a little bit about that as well. And I suppose then fast forward to today, 2024, I suppose, what is your kind of breakdown between what you're doing through your wholesale routes or working with independent stores versus like what you're doing direct to consumer right now?
So direct to consumer is a smaller part of our business. Our business model in the last 8 years have been retail. We've been hitting that pretty hard, getting on the shelves. So we have small chains that maybe have 4 to 10 stores, 15 stores. We do direct to store on the smaller ones. So we have like a route that we go around and fill up shelves. Big ones like Kroger, Meyer, we have distributors. We use Le Perry as our main distributor. And they do a phenomenal job. They have us in the whole time zone. I'm all the way down to Florida. Spartan Nash is a huge distributor for us. They also own about 150 and operate 150 50 stores. So Spartanish gets us into independents as well as their family fairs, DW Fresh, VGs. And that's pretty much it. Online orders, I mean, we don't get a ton, but we still do it. You know, we're not in California yet, but people that move away or send it to their family members, fall in love with it and can't get it, they order it online and we ship it out.
You know, that definitely makes sense. I think a lot of food and beverage CPG type products, I mean, obviously with this, the cost of like doing things logistically, shipping and the weight of things nowadays, especially with something like salsa, which can be like pretty aqueous. So like, I assume it's pretty heavy. I know with like packaged drinks is one of the most difficult things just from the weight, trying to ship can be really, really difficult. So it definitely makes sense that you're doing mostly wholesale, right? And then I guess from the DTC selling that you've been doing, obviously since the beginning, has anything kind of surprised you as far as obviously when you sell, you know, direct, like one of the advantages and just like things you could see, obviously is a little bit more information about the customers, having that little more like direct interaction. Do you think you've maybe like carved out a niche with this product, whether it's like a vegetarian group or a specific like age or different like demographic? Have you noticed anything like that since you've been selling online in any way, or is it pretty just like wide ranging? Anybody who loves salsa?
It's everybody. I can't put my finger on it. In my website, I put, you know, anybody from 9 to 99. Little Diablo may be a misnomer to some people because it's not all hot. You know, we only have one hot. So people that we have a sweet, we have mild, you know, we have a chipotle, we have a roasted garlic that's mild. There's a lot of people fall in love with our sweet pineapple. Very mild, very fresh tasting. We're just all over the map.
No, that's awesome. I love that. With a product like this, I'm not surprised. And I suppose, what was the original product? I wanted to ask too, like, what was the first SKU that you obviously have expanded now into the 5 or 6 you just mentioned, but like, what was the original? Was it just kind of like a medium, like
it was, nice, it was the medium, you know, we threw some jalapenos and some Hungarian peppers in there, and we used Hungarian peppers because we ran out of jalapeno, but we just love the flavor that the Hungarians give. So we put Hungarians in all of them, the mild, the medium, the hot. So the hot has habaneros in it and the jalapenos and the Hungarian. So you kind of get the flavor of all the peppers, and then the heat will kind of creep up and hit you, linger and go away and repeat the process.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I guess I'm curious too, whenever I talk about somebody who's, you know, in CPG and mostly in wholesale doing retailers, obviously one of the biggest pain points and hardest things to figure out is like shelf placement naturally, right? I can imagine, you know, it's a challenge with a product like salsa where there are so many now, but I think when you started, there probably wasn't as much of a like saturation of like different types of salsas like you see in the grocery store now. So how do you kind of approach that working with these retailers to make sure that, you know, your product still has a chance to stand out amongst a sea of salsas, seemingly in most of the grocery stores, at least that I go to?
So their shelves are treated like real estate and it's not free. You know, you buy the space, you rent the space. You know, a lot of stores want free product to bring it in to try it. You know, they call it slotting fees. They'll call it, you know, free fills. The bigger ones want more money. Of course, you got the volume and they're going to want getting their ads, put it on sale, run promotions. The big thing that I love doing, the biggest bang for buck, is doing in-store demos. And I still do those when I get a chance because I get to touch every customer that comes up and tries it. I get feedback. You know, I get to tell my elevator pitch. You know, everyone wants to know how you got started and how long you've been doing it. When you still see people try your salsa for the first time and fall in love with it, it's just a great feeling.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I know the in-store demos seem to be a really big hitter for almost everybody that I talk to in this space, which makes perfect sense, right? I mean, you're there, you get that direct experience, explain a little bit more about the background, form that real connection with somebody. It definitely makes sense. And I always appreciate the perspectives on, you know, kind of just like approaching those conversations. If maybe something isn't performing in one specific store, maybe it is somewhere else. I know folks have kind of taken, I think it could be really important to, like, you know, find the success stories if you are in a bunch of different retail locations and say like, hey, like, I know that it works really well here. Here's the data to support it. You know, maybe we can think about doing that. It works better for everybody, kind of feel. I know those conversations cannot always be easy. So I suppose, what was kind of the first like big chain, like retail location that you got into after you like moved on from kind of like the local scene in Detroit?
In Michigan, there was a large chain called Aco, and they had like 70 stores, and it was a hardware, almost like an Ace. And they had a little snack section and at the register, kind of an impulse thing. And I pitched to them, got turned down, pitched again, got turned down, kept dropping off salsas. Finally, a new buyer came and saw my salsa sitting on the table, tried it, loved it, got a hold of me, and they ended up getting 4 pallets, took it into all their stores, and that was the single largest, my first largest order in a large chain. So that was good on the resume. You know, it was a well-known store. They only brought in quality quality product. And that kind of got the traction going. That got the momentum going. And that's actually when I ended up quitting my job, when I got into that. And then there's other, the local chains like Bush's. Then they all just kind of followed after that. You get into some of the, you know, the Plum Markets, the Nino's, Bush's, Better Health. You got to have a healthy product to get into those. It just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And it might seem obvious in retrospect, you know, thinking back to when you got started, but I think a lot of people can forget how important those just like in-person, just kind of like real interactions and like, you know, persistence can be. I think there's such a big focus on, you know, online presence and maybe like trying to go viral on social media or like, you know, spending money on, you know, digital advertising and things like that to get started. But I think things like that are equally, if not more important, even in 2024 today. So I appreciate you sharing that experience as well. And then Doug, I know I mentioned it before we started, the question I always love to ask on the podcast. So if you could go back to, I believe I at least you saw on your LinkedIn, I don't know if this is the exact year, but if you could go back to, you know, 2011, 10, 12 years ago, when you first started with this brand, right before you kind of got like, you know, 2 feet in with it and did it full time. If you give yourself any one piece of advice, if you were to start this business again, what do you think that piece of advice would be?
Don't do it. No, I'm kidding.
You'll not believe how many times I get that knee jerk reaction to that question. And then it's always the follow up is like, no, of course I would never do anything different. That's amazing. Right. I love it. I love it.
Don't quit. I mean, you know, I had a really good high paying corporate job. When I quit that, I mean, I didn't even gross what I was making bringing home at my job for the first 3 years. So don't quit. I would say don't quit. And every couple of years, like, why am I doing this? What am I doing this for? So now looking back, you know, there was a few times when I could have called it quits and went back to a cushy job, and I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, I think it's really good advice. And as I mentioned before, you're probably not surprised to hear it's kind of a very common reaction to that question. But I think for anybody who's in the early stages of their kind of journey as an entrepreneur, especially in the CPG space, one of the other most common answers I get to that question is like, basically understand that it's going to take like five times as long as you think it is in the beginning. Yeah. So I think those two things coupled, once you hear it, you know, 25, 30 times, it's not really anecdotal anymore. When you talk to so many, you know, people in the CPG space that have had success that say the same things. So I appreciate you kind of adding to that conversation, reaffirming that for anybody who listens to the podcast. I think it's the two of the most important things is, you know, that roadmap and timeline is probably going to take a lot longer than you think in CPG. And yeah, just to not quit, just to understand that like everybody feels that way in their first few years. You're probably going to take a monetary hit if you had a good job before.
Yeah.
And you're going to feel like, you know, why am I doing this is obviously a big one too. So I really appreciate that. And this one thing I definitely try to bring on the podcast is just like real life experiences in a sea of everybody just talking about how their overnight success is online, and everything you hear everywhere is just everybody's a genius and everybody has the greatest idea ever and they make $1 million a day. So I really appreciate that.
Don't pay attention to that noise.
Yeah, no, you can't. You just can't. Yeah. And everything, every time you see that online, it's so funny. You see somebody posting like that on social media and they're like, I made this much money doing this. And it's like, so it's so easy. It's so easy. If you're not driving a Lambo by 25, what are you doing? And then you go into their link and they're trying to sell you a course on how to do it. It's like, oh, sure. I see. So, okay, yeah. You know, you don't have millions of dollars. You're trying to get me to buy a $100 course. But no, that's awesome. So Doug, I just want to give you an opportunity as well, real quick, just to, you know, shout out your website. Are there any social medias people should know about? If anybody who's listening might be interested in trying this also, where they can find it, or maybe just interested in partnering with you in a business sense, what's the best way to stay in touch with you all?
So our website, littlediabolosalsa.com. I'm on LinkedIn. We have a Facebook, Little Diablo Salsa. You know, our emails, littlediabolosalsa@yahoo.com. Any information, you can of course go to the website and see where we're sold at. We're probably 1,800 stores, a ton of independents, and all those or most of those are on the website. It's changing daily as we pick up more stores. So we're trying to stay diligent and getting that caught up, but you can buy it on our website. You know, we have a sample pack now, free shipping. It's 6-pack. So you can sample, you know, 6 of our top flavors and get it shipped to you free.
Awesome. Well, Doug, I just want to say thank you again for coming on and sharing your experiences. I just want to wish you the best of luck and continued success in everything that you're doing. And really look forward to staying in touch as well. Thanks again for coming on.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, everybody.